So if you ask me to give you the name of an organization that has pushed climate change denial and confusion and delay so that they can make billions and billions of dollars, I would start out with ExxonMobil. I might also give you like Conoco, Chevron, but there is a kind of oil company that's bigger than all of those. In fact, if you add up every oil company in the world, that will be responsible for less than half of the world's oil production. I think that this is important because if we only think of oil and gas through the lens of how it currently works in, like, actually the minority of cases, which is how I do it, we risk missing some important stuff. Oil companies are enormous. They have tremendous economic and political influence, but that is a very visible tip of an iceberg. And behind them, there is a deeper structure, a structure that might be even harder to control and push back again than behemoths like ExxonMobil. But also, maybe not. Maybe there's also a reason for optimism. So first, let's talk about these super majors. These are the big, big oil producers. There's a bunch of smaller oil companies you never heard of, but there's a bunch of big ones. They're very powerful. They're very big. ExxonMobil is the poster child. It's the only energy company that consistently sits at the top of U.S. companies. Exxon is a fossil fuel firm that is punching into that territory. Its market cap is in the hundreds of billions. But there's others. You've heard of them. Shell, BP, Chevron. These are globally operating oil and gas firms that control everything from extraction to transport to refining. They're behemoths. They have revenues and influence comparable to major countries. Now, because these companies are publicly traded, or at least partially public, they are somewhat transparent, they have metrics, they have branding, they have footprints that we can look at, and they're culturally legible villains. And let me be clear, I think that they are villains, and I think that we should treat them that way, and I think that some portion of people will have like a more robust understanding of this. I hope that you're one of them. Most people won't, and we shouldn't be like, oh, you gotta understand that actually ExxonMobil isn't that. No, that's not what we should do. We should continue to treat them as the villains that they are. But I think it'd be better if some portion of people had like the bigger picture in their heads, and you're gonna be one of those people. There's gonna be lots of different ways of doing it, and all the different ways are gonna be good. These companies have engineered disaster for profit. Because of the size of these companies, it was a big surprise to me when I first learned a couple of years ago that if you add all of them up, they aren't even most of the story. There is a bigger force, and it's not in my yard, you know? So like, it's not how things work where I live. So it totally makes sense that I wouldn't focus on this. But in terms of the world, in terms of extraction, production, burning, creation of all of this oil and gas, state-owned oil companies control the vast majority of all oil reserves. I've seen estimates that only 12% of global oil and gas reserves are held by the supermajors. Finding out that only a fraction of the oil in the world is produced by the companies I always think about as the only people involved in this, it feels the same as finding out that like matter is only a fraction of the matter of the universe. There's like a dark matter of oil. And where I live, the supermajors are the important people to pay attention to. But globally, most oil production and most oil reserves are under sovereign control. It's oil drilled and traded by national governments or state oil companies. And in many ways, these are also oil companies. They've got the same business model as the companies, but they exist behind a different structure, and those differences matter. Quickly, to cut in with a sponsor for this video, it is helpful when thinking about the complexities of the world to have a place that brings a lot of news together and also doesn't break the business model of the news. Ground News has a section about the oil and gas sector, and would you believe it, U.S. excludes Rosneft Germany from Russia sanctions. We are actually talking about the complexity of the actual whole oil and gas sector. The Russian central bank is cutting a key rate by 50 basis points after new U.S. oil sanction. And we can look and see where it is being covered and see where we want to read about it. In this Irish news outlet, RTE, we could do that. I think that they're a pretty respectable outlet and we could read about it there. And look, now we're on their website. Ground News is very useful for being able to dig into context, looking at specific stuff that I'm interested in, finding the different ways people are talking about those things. It's a website and also an app that gathers related articles from around the world in one place and gives you context about the sources you're looking at, their political leaning, their reliability, who owns them, and you can compare coverage quickly and easily between different outlets. This story about military strikes on alleged drug-running boats in the Eastern Pacific, killing 14. We got the Epoch Times saying the U.S. kills 14 narco-terrorists in 4 boats in the Pacific. And we got the left saying U.S. military strikes 4 alleged drug boats in Eastern Pacific, killing 14. So here's the deal. You could get 40% off the Vantage plan if you subscribe with the link ground.news/Hank, or scan the QR code that's been on the screen the whole time, or you could click on the link that's in the description. So use that link, get the discount, and have a new tool in your arsenal. So here's the situation. How do we decide who owns the oil under the ground of a nation? In places like the US or Canada or the UK, history here is that private companies are permitted to lease the land from the government or from private citizens, but mostly from the government. And then they drill there and they get the oil that they drill. So they're paying the government for the land, but anything that they get from the land, that's theirs. The government also regulates them and it sets the price for the land lease. But once you've got the lease, the private company does whatever and they can make whatever profit they can make. But in most places, that's not how you do it. In most places, you say, look, this land is owned by these people. This is the country's land. And the stuff inside of the land is also owned by the people. So the people, or at least the country, should be the one to profit from the sale of the stuff. So yeah, in most countries, the country itself claims full ownership of subsurface resources. And that means the national government or a state oil company holds the rights to do all that stuff, to drill, to do the refining, to sell it, to decide which projects to do, to permit which projects happen, and also to regulate itself. Importantly, these countries do often partner with foreign or private companies like Exxon, like Conoco, in joint ventures or service contracts, because those companies have a lot of technology, they have a lot of experience. So if a country doesn't have all the expertise yet to do all the extraction itself, these oil companies are often still involved in this. But the state is the dominant actor, the state is making all of the decision, and it also takes the profit of the sale of the oil and it uses it to fund the government. There's a lot of reasons for this. So sovereignty and control is a big one. It's also political and economic leverage. Like, if you own the oil, you can direct how much to extract, you can set price conditions, you can use that for state building. Also, state control helps governments capture more of the surplus rather than giving it to the wealthy shareholders of an oil company who often in other countries aren't even from that country. It's not just like some billionaire, it's some billionaire in America. And of course, it becomes a source of revenue, which can support social spending, it can support infrastructure spending, it can support a very wealthy royal family. And also many states that do it this way, they nationalized their oil and gas sector during decolonization. The oil sector was a natural place to do this. So in America, we're actually a little weird that we are not mostly operated by state oil firms. We're like this for a bunch of historical reasons. We don't need to get into it. Obviously, we're very capitalist, but also in like the old times when this was first happening, the government didn't know how to exploit the oil. And so they were like, well, just lease the land, pay us and do whatever you can. And once that system was set up, it was kind of set up. It's very hard to change it. Whereas in other places where more of the technology already existed when the oil and gas started to be exploited in those places, it was just easier for it to be nationalized. But also, like, the U.S. is very sort of like ideologically capitalist and private ownership, and that's good. And we also have like diversified revenue sources. Like, we don't need to depend. I think that it would be great if we could, but we don't need to depend on oil as heavily. And that can actually like avoid some potential messy consequences. Oil revenue is an inconsistent source of revenue. Prices fluctuate a lot. And it can be pretty bad if your national like spending is based on a price that fluctuates. And so ours isn't, but ultimately, ExxonMobil does okay. Point is, the way we do it seems very normal to us. Globally, it's actually pretty weird. The top producers in the world today are typically state-controlled or national oil companies. The world's biggest state-owned oil company is, of course, Saudi Aramco. There's Rosneft in Russia, NIOC in Iran. There's Petrobras, of course, in Brazil. Venezuela has a really big one. Saudi Aramco produces roughly 10 million barrels per day. It's estimated to account for 10% of all global oil supply. The state oil companies in China together control huge domestic output and also abroad investing. So they actually will go to other countries the way that like ExxonMobil will do it. And they'll do like a service contract there. State firms act differently from private ones. They sometimes will subordinate profit to political goals. They might overextend investment for geopolitical reasons rather than like looking at what's going to be best for the bottom line. But importantly, that oil is burned everywhere. Like, it does not just stay where it is. It gets burned in the US and in Europe and in Asia. The amount of production from these companies is in excess of all private companies combined. I talked about this a little at the top, but our discourse, of course, is focused on Exxon, and you have probably not heard of CNPC. You may have heard of Saudi Aramco. You may have heard of Petrobras, but I can't even think of the name of the Venezuelan one, and it's huge. So why do we focus on Exxon? I think good reasons, and I don't think we should stop doing it. So Exxon is more public. You actually can know more about what it's doing because there's a bunch of regulations for what it has to share because it's a publicly traded company. Also, they are how it is done where we are, and that is the majority of the political power I have. Like, I can't decide what's going to happen in China. I can't decide what's going to happen in Brazil. But I do have a voice in terms of what's going to happen in America. And so, of course, I'm thinking about how the American system works. I think this is good. I think there's also an element of like tying all bad things together with like one economic system. And like, there's lots of economic systems and they're very complicated. And you could say that they're all kind of capitalism. But like, state-owned oil is very definitely not capitalism. That is you know, it's state ownership of a company. That's not how capitalism does stuff. And so I think there's like a simplicity of narrative here. Like, we don't tend to be mad at Norway. In fact, mostly we're like happy about Norway. We're like, what a great example of a hybrid capitalist socialist country. But with this expanded view, it's good to keep in mind that they are a petrostate. And I'm not saying that they're unique in that, but they're a petrostate with a very small population. Like, their sovereign wealth fund is equal to about 1.5% of all of the world's publicly traded companies combined. And they have fewer people than Houston. There's like leverage in terms of how the country works. So you can sue Exxon. You can subpoena them. You can protest them. You can ratchet financial pressure on Exxon. You can elect leaders who will not be as friendly to Exxon. If you are Saudi or Chinese, you mostly can't do that with Aramco or CNPC. And that's a problem. That's a thing that I worry a lot about. If we think that it's hard to regulate Exxon with all of the influence that they already have in government, which they do, they have a huge amount. But like, imagine what it looks like when Exxon is the government. Because in a lot of places, the oil company and the state are effectively the same thing. And we have to phase out fossil fuels. And that's really hard to do with a private industry that employs a lot of people. Imagine doing it when the oil and gas industry employs a lot of people, but also the revenues pay for a big chunk of the national budget. In cases like that, cutting down on production isn't like, ah, the government hurt a business. It's like the government hurt itself. That might affect schools and pensions and roads, the social safety net, and also the wealth of a bunch of powerful people in the country. So there's this effect. It's called the resource curse. When a country leans a lot on natural resources, that can distort the whole country. Like, the currency will get stronger during booms for the research, and that makes other industries less competitive against that industry. And so then you end up in a country that's exporting less of everything that's not that resource. The fluctuation means that national budgets can balloon as high price years go for like year after year after year. But then when you have a low price year or series of years, you're in income can no longer support the budget. Also, corruption risks go up higher when there's a single ministry that is controlling just a fire hose of cash. And because so much power flows through that resource, leaders have really strong incentives to centralize control and weaken independent institutions that might constrain that. There are ways to get around this. Norway is a good example of a place that I think has done a good job of getting around this, like making sure that they're extracting and then benefiting and like controlling corruption. And it's a small place with a lot of cultural identity. And I think that they have done a good job of it. There are other places where this can be a recipe for long-term instability and definitely a bad recipe for like action on climate, which again, Norway has done an okay job of. They like have saved up a lot of money and now they're like, okay, we're gonna feel better about our oil production by making sure everybody drives electric cars. A fundamental truth of climate change is that a very large portion of the unburned fossil fuels in the world need to stay underground. Like, that is the best way to store carbon, is to keep it where it is stored. And that is much harder to do when that unburned carbon is actually on a nation's balance sheet. That is a resource they have that they can turn into money for doing things that they want to do. Whether that's a corrupt thing or a good thing, it can go both ways. But asking a government to leave the money that funds its budget in the ground, like it's just down there in the ground, and saying, don't dig up that money, that's hard. So to be clear here, my focus as a citizen of the United States of America is on Exxon. It's on Conoco, it's on Chevron. Like, it's on the American oil industry because that's here. And look, almost everyone is people who haven't watched this video, right? So almost everyone, that's what the focus should be on. But for people with a wider scope, and I think that some people should have a wider scope, we have to also recognize that any realistic path has to make leave it in the ground politically survivable for a lot of nation states. And that's complicated. That looks like a big mix of new revenue sources, maybe debt relief tied to conservation, debt relief tied to keeping carbon in the ground, or even, look, I know this is wild, but paying people with resources, like, this is so hard to do because they will claim that they have more resources than they have inevitably. But if you say, hey, how about we pay you to leave it in the ground? That, and like, I hesitate to even say that because for how long, you know, until the regime changes, until when? The thing is, if you can keep it in the ground for another 50 years, it'll probably stay in the ground because we'll have better systems by then. And part of that is going to be a very boring process of economic diversification, creating ways for leaders to take like least painful first steps without getting immediately punished by their voters or by other people inside of their political system who, you know, are living large on the fire hose of just pointing at their face. Ah! And also, importantly, they can get punished by the people who have loaned them the money. So they don't just have a bunch of fossil fuel cash. Oftentimes they take out loans to build the infrastructure or just to fund the government. And like part of that is that the people who loan them the money, the banks or the governments are like, we know you're going to be able to pay us back because you got a bunch of money right there in the ground. But if the money needs to stay in the ground, we have to figure out how to get the people who loaned them some money to be like, actually, it's okay to leave it in the ground. Point is, as a U.S. citizen, I'm thinking about like the villainy of ExxonMobil. As a person who shares one atmosphere with the entire planet, I'm also thinking about CNPC. Though speaking of China, because this complicates the story in an interesting way, China produces a lot of oil. It has big state oil companies, and it is also the world's largest importer of oil. And in the weird way, it is already making China a bit of a savior here. Because they have this strategic vulnerability, China has pushed very hard to get off of oil on the demand side. So huge investments in battery technology, in electric vehicles, electric buses, delivery fleets, rail, critical minerals for batteries, all of this stuff. They are seeing the future so clearly, and there is a benefit to the whole world of that. Like, they've got good cars that cost $15,000 over there. And in America, where the average cost of a car is now $50,000, it would be nice if those were available here. Now, China is still going to invest in new oil exploitation where they are and elsewhere. They're definitely going to use oil and gas. They're definitely going to sell it to other people who are going to use it. But they are also at the same time figuring out how to burn less themselves. And that is strategically a really strong move. It's probably very good for the world because that technology isn't going to stay within its borders. And we've already seen that that's paid dividends as battery and solar prices have plummeted because of that investment. But still, for clarity, they do want to keep selling oil, and many places in the world are going to keep buying it. So when I say the dark matter of oil, I mean that there is a vast hidden mass of oil production and influence that is beyond the firms that I point to as an American citizen, that I can directly affect as an American citizen. I mean, not directly, hopefully indirectly, hopefully some amount of effect. I know that can feel hope. I live in Montana, you guys, but that's just the stars that we see. There is other like gravitational force here holding everything together, and it is made largely of governments. But I do have an optimistic note to end on, and I don't think that this is naive. There are strong forces nudging governments and private companies to leave more oil in the ground. So first, demand for oil plateaus as vehicles electrify and as cities invest in transit. And that means that the marginal barrel gets less valuable over time. And clean power keeps getting cheaper, and that might make domestic electricity a better development bet than volatile export revenue with like this resource curse stuff that comes along with it. Electricity is not as susceptible to the resource curse because it can prop up a lot of local industries in a way that oil can't as easily. If you have cheap electricity, you can have a lot of cheap other stuff. And then there's this effect called transition risk, and that just means the financial danger of being too slow to change. If the world really does move away from fossil fuels, and I think a lot of people think that that's going to happen, and not just for like climate reasons, but that's part of it. The value of oil reserves, refineries, and pipelines can all fall really fast. So if you spend $10 billion on a pipeline with the idea that oil is going to cost $200 a barrel, and then it costs $80 a barrel, now that huge investment that you just made is no longer viable. It no longer pays for itself. You have a bigger loan than you can pay for with it. People know about this. Governments are aware of this. And especially governments that depend on oil revenue know this. Also, banks and investors know it, and they want to have their money come back. So there are reasons that it starts to make more sense to diversify. Now, not necessarily to just stop pumping. That's not happening anytime soon. But diversifying now, while you can still get a good price for your oil, is a good idea rather than like waiting until nobody wants to buy it after you spent billions of dollars on pipelines and refineries. And I do think that people like care about cheaper and more reliable power. I think they care about their governments being not corrupt and you know, economically stable. I think they care about clean air. I, as a person who converted to electric 5 years ago, I am shocked at the amount of gasoline that gets burned around me. And I'm like at school and I'm walking with my son, just breathing in stuff that comes out of the back of cars. I think that eventually this will become quite popular, and politicians like popular things. Now, we're going to watch in America as this has already happened. You know, electric vehicles have become politicized. Elon Musk can love Trump as much as anything, but Trump voters still don't want electric cars. They want big trucks that make big noises. I'm generalizing, but on average, electric vehicles are more of a left-leaning thing. But there really are also like international things that a strong coalition of governments could do if we had that anymore. And like now I'm feeling more hopeless. But there are things you can do. There's ways to finance transitions when people are overly reliant on fossil fuels and to say, hey, you know, you are dealing with a resource curse, you're dealing with these transition costs, like we can help bridge that in one way or another with like low interest or, you know, some kind of development funds. But a lot of that relies on global inter-country cooperation, which some of this is kind of like stuff that will just happen because technology will get better and fossil fuels will become like our less relevant technology. But the speed at which this happens matters so much. And it is not at all, like, this transition could take 200 years. And if it does, then all bets are off with regard to how livable the planet is. Like, it really matters how fast we do it. And the speed is not automatic at all. It's going to be based on the decisions of people. But by far the most important thing, and this is going to sound weird, but it is getting the price of oil down low enough that taking it out of the ground isn't worthwhile. That's going to seem weird because you would think we need the price of oil to be higher. But the higher the price of oil is, the more profitable it is to pump it. Now, there are ways to raise the price of oil. Like, a carbon tax is not that. So you could have an increase in the price of oil that keeps oil like at the current price, but makes it that keeps oil. This is a weird idea. I'm having an idea right now. What if there was a system that said oil has to be $3.50 a gallon? And if it is ever lower than that, then all of that money is going to pay for universal basic income or something. I don't know. Something good that everybody likes. I don't know. I'm just thinking. Like, ultimately, the thing that matters is how much the oil company gets paid, not how much you pay at the pump, because there's all kinds of things that affect that. Like, obviously, if the oil has to be shipped from Saudi Arabia, all of that cost gets added onto it. Point is, if it costs more to pump and ship it, than it is worth to the consumer, it will stop getting pumped and shipped. I don't think that we're anywhere near as far down that path as we need to be or as we could have been without the tremendous power of the fossil fuel industry in America and also the tremendous power of the fossil fuel industry everywhere else. But demand will go down eventually and the supply will follow, whether that is private or state-owned. That is like the ultimate control we have here. But as different as these systems are, they are both subject to the same final rule that if people aren't using it as much, they will not produce as much. So we have to figure out ways where people use it less. Whether it is private or state-owned, that effect still exists. And I think that China is right that the biggest way to affect that is to create technologies that are better. And as an EV driver who can charge at home, it is better. I understand that that's not the case if you can't charge at home, but if you can charge at home, it is so much better. It is just better.